is actually the best part of your service, I think. Especially when you've got a great children's story, which I do. I don't know if any of you know this story. You know this one? Your program says Ruby May, M-A-Y, has something to say. It's actually her name, Ruby May, M-A-E. Although, when you hear the story, I think you'll agree that Ruby, M-A-Y, is kind of appropriate, too. You might know this author, David Small. He wrote Imogene's Antlers. Another popular... Okay, same person wrote this book. The town of Nada, Texas was small. You could stand on one side of town, whisper something, and be heard on the other side. It was that small. Still, Nada had a few things in it. There was a general store, an abandoned train depot, a three-legged dog, and the World Headquarters for Universal Peace and Understanding. The World Headquarters was in the home of Miss Ruby May Foote. Ruby May had a big dream. She wanted to speak at the United Nations in New York City to deliver her message of universal peace and understanding. But Ruby May also had a big problem. She was tongue-tied, which meant sometimes she mixed up the letters of words. Without meaning to, sometimes she insulted people. At other times, for no apparent reason, she was just plain incomprehensible. Because of this, the residents of Nada had written off Ruby May as a goofball. But Ruby May has a nephew named Billy Bob in Texas. Billy Bob wanted to be an inventor of things that would benefit all humanity. But try as he might, he could think of nothing new. Then one day he had an idea, and he went into the kitchen and he made this thing. He took a colander. Do you know what a colander is? It's like a strainer, something to put to drain pasta in or vegetables in. It's got little holes in it. He stuck a bunch of things in it. Ruby May, Aunt Ruby May, your troubles are over. I've just invented this. And now you can give your message to the world. Feel anything? When he put it on her head, Ruby May said, no. Well, so he worked on it a little bit longer. Tried it again, and it worked. And she became this great speaker. She had to have this thing on her head. Nothing daunted Ruby May now that she could talk straight. First she became mayor of Nada, then governor of Texas. We wish. Hers was a meteoric rise. Curiously, she never appeared in public without a big hat on her head. Billy Bob's invention was in need of a name. They called it the Bobatron. As time went on, Billy Bob made additions and improvements, so it kind of grew. So Ruby May's hats kind of grew also. And at last it happened. Ruby May was invited to speak at the United Nations General Assembly. She and Billy Bob went to New York, and she was wearing this big hat covered with doves of peace. But then, oh no, disaster struck. A pigeon hawk came down and took the hat off of her head. Ruby May looked pale and unnerved. Billy Bob whispered, Aunt Ruby May, I've been meaning to tell you, you don't need that old piece of junk on your head to speak well. It's all in your mind. You can get your message through without it. So Ruby May went up in front of all these world leaders, and out came... Her words were a meaningless babble. Billy Bob quickly ran down to the basement of the United Nations building into the kitchen, shoving all the chefs out of the way. And he made this thing, and he got in the elevator, and he went up, and he put it on Ruby May's head. Oh, it looked pretty silly. She's got this really funny, silly thing on her head. As Ruby May turned to the audience, her head crowned with its tangle of copper, aluminum, tin, and wire, a mild titter arose in the room. The titter grew to a chorus of guffaws and cackles. At last, the whole lot of world leaders was convulsed in laughter. Then Ruby May stepped forward and raised her hand for silence. "My friends," she said in a level tone, "leaders of the free world, my message to you is simple. To achieve universal peace and understanding on this planet, you only have to speak plainly, even though you may look foolish. This is 1,000 times better than looking good and talking nonsense." The planet Earth was small. You could stand on one side, whisper something, and be heard on the other side. It was that small. Still, Earth had a few things on it. For one thing, it had NADA Texas, Ruby May Foote, and the World Headquarters for Universal Peace and Understanding. Well, I'm introducing myself, so I don't want to scare anybody away, but I actually am a Unitarian Universalist minister. So, and thank you. I'm kind of an itinerant preacher at the moment, I guess you could call me, because this is very long and complicated. I'm not going to give you my life history, but I'm geographically bound. More about that at some other point in time. So I'm very happy to be here, and I thank you very much for inviting me. I like to start with a couple of readings. These are short readings. The first one is just a few lines from Martin Luther King Jr. "We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Hatred and bitterness can never cure the disease of fear. Only love can do that. We must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. We shall hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope." And this, one of my favorite poems, is written by Wendell Berry. "When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water, and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free." I had intended to talk about something else this morning. When Paula and I were, several months ago now, planning some services, then September 11th happened. I changed my topic. But then I thought, as today grew closer, so many words have already been said about the terrorist attacks. So many words are being said even as I speak. Just turn on the Sunday morning television shows with the talking heads. What can I possibly add to the cacophony of words? And why should I even want to? Even though it hasn't been 4 weeks yet since the terrorist attacks, there are so many words out there. In some ways, too many words have been uttered. Maybe silence would be the better option. Perhaps we should sit in silence for the next 10 or 15 minutes. But we are Unitarian Universalists. not exactly noted for being silent. So I, of course, rejected that option. Besides, like Ruby May, I have something to say. Having rejected the silence option, I have now gone to the other extreme, in a sense. Don't worry, I'm watching the clock. Even with all the words that have been uttered and are being uttered, we need more words, because it seems quite apparent to me that humans still don't get it. If killing each other is still a very viable option for so many people, obviously we are not speaking clearly enough. We don't have our Bobotron hats on. We are not being heard. The poets among us, such as Wendell Berry and King, are sometimes heard. Poets say things clearly enough, but perhaps not loudly or often enough. If everything has already been said, then why are we waiting with trepidation for either our government to retaliate with some kind of attack somewhere, or for another terrorist attack? Humans haven't spoken the right words yet, the words that would wake us up to the reality of our need for each other, of our need for plurality, of our need for, if you will, religious or sacred witness. Sometimes the right words do get spoken, but not often enough or clearly enough or strongly enough to be heard. A lot of the words that I think need to be uttered have been said over and over again, such as the words to imagine that the three of you sang so wonderfully a few minutes ago. How do we, as whatever it is we call ourselves, secular humanists, religious humanists, Christians, or merely people who find comfort in gathering in this space week after week but are uncomfortable with any religious label, how do we utter words that have a sacred dimension to them? Words that come from some wellspring of sacredness. How do we, as people of faith, respond to this strange, inexplicable new world we find ourselves in? Where do we religious liberals fit in the discussion out there, in the real world? Do we take the ideals and the beliefs that we hopefully feel free to express in here, out there? Is there a place for the spiritual and the sacred in the conversation, in the aftermath of all the awful things that happened and may happen again? Yes, I think so. Now more than ever, I believe that we have a window of opportunity, or perhaps more accurately, a window of necessity, a moment in time to fill the vacuum with clear, forceful language, language that is spiritual and sacred. There is a great need to put on our Bobotron hats and, like Ruby May, step forward, raise our hands for silence and say, "Leaders of the world, my message to you is simple. To achieve universal peace and understanding on this planet, you have only to speak plainly, even though you may look foolish. This is 1,000 times better than looking good and talking nonsense." In order for there to be a place for the spiritual and the sacred in this discussion, I believe that we as Unitarian Universalists need to be very clear about what we mean by the spiritual and the sacred. I am using the words in their broadest sense. I am talking about the sacredness of life, the mystery of existence. What is sacred to me are the relationships we have with each other. Spirituality to me is sensitivity or attachment to values and things of the spirit rather than to material or worldly interests. There is nothing sacred or spiritual about vengeance and retribution. The eye for an eye theory doesn't fit here. Killing innocent people is, to me, not a viable option. Many of you have probably heard that sentence. An eye for an eye only ends up making everyone blind. It's been attributed to Gandhi, but I've also heard it attributed to Martin Luther King Jr. Now, I just want to be very clear here that I'm not talking about ignoring what happened. I'm not in any way suggesting that the September 11th attacks were justified. And I don't believe that I'm totally blameless, but that's a subject for another day. I do not believe that any culpability any of us in the developed world have for those awful events warrants the taking of innocent lives. Clearly, we are doing something wrong. Recently, I had a conversation with a 24-year-old man. He was advocating swift, immediate retribution. I asked him if he believed in taking an eye for an eye. "You bet," he said. He was ready, even eager, to sign up and go and fight, even though he didn't know where or against whom. Well, we weren't on the same page, or probably even in the same book. But he had some good points. "How," he asked me, "can we defend our homes? He has a 6-year-old son that he would do anything to protect, to keep safe." I, of course, did my spiel, my utterances about how vengeance and retribution and the killing of innocents has never worked. Oh, and of course, I did so gently, with compassion, or at least I tried to. Is there any point in talking to people who are so adamant about the need for more violence? Yes, because we need to be heard. There is another way, one that the human race hasn't really ever tried, hasn't given a chance, the sacred way. Using that option is all up to us. What we do in the face of this threat to the sacredness of life is our choice. I was thinking about the words that we need to use now so that we don't get tongue-tied, so that our words don't come out of our mouths all mixed up, so that maybe we don't insult too many people, so that our words aren't just plain incomprehensible. We need to put a firm foundation under our words. We need to get some stories behind them so that we can use them without faltering or stumbling, so that we can get these words into the public discourse. We need to be brave enough to speak up and speak out often. So this morning I offer you 3 words that to me are sacred. 3 words that I think we need to thoroughly explore and understand so that they, the words, will serve to underscore our actions and our discussions in these troubled times. First, love. There cannot be a deep, abiding, not a surfacey love without compassion. This kind of love that I'm talking about taps into the knowledge of our interconnectedness, a love that is based on those 6 degrees of separation, which I've recently heard are really 5. Joanna Macy, one of my professors in seminary, and some of you may know her name, she wrote World as Lover, World as Selves. She's a practicing Buddhist. She tells a story about visiting her son in India, he was studying in a Tibetan community. She says, "One day after my morning time with the children," because she was teaching some of the young children English, "I was walking down the mountain to meet again with some friends. On the way, I had accompanied my oldest 11-year-old son to a Dharma class for Westerners at a school for young Tibetan lamas. The English-speaking nun in charge was teaching, and she said, "So countless are all sentient beings, and so many their births throughout time, that each at some point was your mother." Now, Joanna Macy did not then, and as far as I know, does not now, believe in reincarnation. This nun then explained a practice for developing compassion. It consisted of viewing each person as your mother in a former life. "I played with this idea," Macy writes, "as I walked on down the mountain. The astronomical number of lifetimes that the nun's words evolved boggled my mind. Yet the intent of this point practice, for all its far-fetched fantasy, was touching. What a pity, I thought, that this was not a practice I could use, since reincarnation hardly featured as part of my belief system. Then I paused on the path as the figure of a coolie approached. Coolies, or load-bearing laborers, were a familiar sight here, and the most heavily laden of all were those who struggled up the mountain with mammoth logs on their backs. They were low-caste mountain folk, whose bent, gaunt forms were dwarfed by their burdens, many meters long. I had become accustomed to the sight of them, and accustomed as well to the sense of consternation that it triggered in me. I would usually look away in discomfort and pass by with internally muttered judgments about the kind of social and economic system that so exploited its own population. But, Macy says, "this afternoon I stood stock still. I watched the slight, bandy-legged figure move slowly uphill towards me, negotiating its burden. Around the bend. Backing up to prop the rear of the log against the bank and ease the weight of it, the coolie paused to catch his breath. I stopped. I wanted to see his face, but he was still strapped under his log, and I would have had to crouch down under it to look up at his features, which I ached now to see. What face did she now wear, this dear one who had long ago mothered me? I wanted to undo and rearrange the straps that I might share her burden up the mountain. Whether out of respect or embarrassment, I did not do that. I simply stood 5 feet away and drank in every feature of that form. When the coolie heaved the log off the bank to balance its weight on his back again and proceed uphill, I headed on down the mountain path. I had done nothing to change his life or betray my discovery of our relationship. But the mountainside shone in a different light. The furnishings of my mind had been rearranged, my heart broken open. How odd, I thought, that I did not need to believe in reincarnation for that to happen." I don't know if this happens to you, I'll bet it does, but over and over again, I have experienced this 6 degrees of separation phenomenon. Some of you in this room know that I have a strange job in another life, actually in this life, but another time. I work at the Mustard Museum in Mount Horeb. A couple days ago, I was at the cash register and I rang this couple up for mustard purchases. And they were from Virginia. I don't even know how I knew that, but you know, you're chatting with them as you're bringing things up. And the woman asked me if I knew about some other place in Mount Horeb, and I said, "No, I don't, I'll look it up in the phone book. I've lived in Madison most of my time in Wisconsin. I'm new to Mount Horeb." "Oh," she said, "our daughter and son-in-law just moved to Madison not too long ago." She said, "They bought a house on Chamberlain Avenue." I said, "Oh, I used to live on Chamberlain Avenue." $27.50. Her eyes got big. That's where my daughter and son-in-law live. They had just bought the house. I had not lived there for 10 years, but I had lived there for 15 years. The connections are there. Maybe we miss them because our daily lives can get so scattered, so full of details. Which brings me to the second word, mindfulness. Mindfulness. These stories, these possibilities, these 6 degrees of separation have always been there. But I think we miss them because we're not paying attention. This past Tuesday, you may remember, was a gorgeous day, perfect fall day. Not too warm, not too cold. I took a bike ride. I took a route that I have taken many, many, many times, but I hadn't taken it in a year. It was gorgeous. The sunshine, the leaves changing, rural roads, nobody out there but me. And I was struck by the fact that nothing had changed there. Nothing in the natural world had changed. I went to General Assembly several years ago and heard a speaker, some of you may have heard this same speaker, talking about the interdependent web. And that particular speaker said, humans could fall off the face of the earth tomorrow and the other species wouldn't even notice. In fact, they'd probably be better off. Our lives seem so cluttered, so noisy, so disjointed. Too often, I think we make decisions that have far-reaching consequences, and we don't give them, these decisions, a thought. We don't think about, we don't ask the question, how does what we do every day affect other people and other beings? Robert Fulghum, Unitarian minister, tells a wonderful story that I think illustrates what mindfulness and paying attention is all about. Fulghum says, V.P. Menon was a significant political figure in India during its struggle for independence from Britain in World War II, after World War II. He was the highest ranking Indian in the viceregal establishment, and it was to him that Lord Mountbatten turned for the final drafting of the Charter Plan for Independence. Unlike most of the leaders of that independence movement, Menon was a rarity, a self-made man. No degree from Oxford or Cambridge graced his office walls, and he had no caste or family ties to support his ambitions. Eldest son of 12 children, he quit school at 13 and worked as a laborer, coal miner, factory hand, merchant, and school teacher. He talked his way into a job as a clerk in the Indian administration, and his rise was rapid, largely because of his integrity and brilliant skills in working with both Indian and British officials in a productive way. Both Nehru and Mountbatten mentioned his name with highest praise as one who made practical freedom possible for his country. Two characteristics stood out as particularly memorable: a kind of aloof, impersonal efficiency, and a reputation for personal charity. His daughter explained the background of this latter trait after he died. When Menon arrived in Delhi to seek a job in government, all his possessions, including his money and his ID, were stolen at the railroad station. He would have to return home on foot, defeated. In desperation, he turned to an elderly Sikh, explained his troubles, and asked for a temporary loan of 15 rupees to tide him over until he could get a job. The Sikh gave him the money. When Menon asked for his address so that he could repay the man, the Sikh said that Menon owed the debt to any stranger who came to him in need as long as he lived. The help came from a stranger and was to be repaid to a stranger. Menon never forgot that debt, neither the gift of trust nor the 15 rupees. His daughter said that the day before Menon died, a beggar came to the family home in Bangalore asking for help to buy new sandals, for his feet were covered with sores. Menon asked his daughter to take 15 rupees out of his wallet to give to the man. It was Menon's last conscious act. Fulgham writes, "This story was told to me by a man whose name I do not know. He was standing beside me in the Bombay airport at the left baggage counter. I had come to reclaim my bags and had no Indian currency left. The agent would not take a traveler's check, and I was uncertain about getting my luggage and making my plane. The man paid my claim check fee, about 80 cents, and told me the story as a way of refusing my attempt to figure out how to repay him. His father had been Menon's assistant and had learned Menon's charitable ways and passed them on to his son. The son had continued the tradition of seeing himself in debt to strangers, whenever, however. From a nameless Sikh to an Indian civil servant, to his assistant, to his son, to me, a white foreigner in a moment of frustrating inconvenience. The gift was not large, as money goes, and my need was not great, but the spirit of the gift is beyond price and leaves me blessed and in debt." This story leads us nicely into the third and final, last word, so to speak, of the day, hope. But not hope on the surface, as in, I hope you feel better, I hope you win the game, I hope you can come to the party. Hope that comes from a deep abiding place. It's a humorous story. And there is a place for humor in all of this. George Bernard Shaw wrote, "Life does not cease to be funny when people die any more than it ceases to be serious when people laugh." And Lord Buckley supposedly wrote, "Terror is the absence of humor. Humor is the absence of terror." Fulgham writes about a friend of his, a lawyer friend who made his annual summer visit last week up from California, traveling with two 18-year-old girls and a small boa constrictor. In an anemic VW van with "Peace, Love, Light" written on the side. The inside of the bus was decorated like the set for Alice in Wonderland. He's 47. Wife, four kids, house in the Berkeley Hills, job in the city with a big firm, the whole catastrophe. I keep up with him because he's always a little ahead of the times. He's taken all the trips, and I do mean all the trips. A walking sociological experiment of the 60s and 70s in American culture. Civil rights, Vietnam, hip, TA, TM, vegetarian, Zen, massage, LSD, palmistry, 10 brands of yoga, macrame, psychoanalysis, backpacking, hot tubs, nudism, crystals, more religious movements than you can name, and vitamins. He's got all the equipment. Blenders and pipes and grinders and bikes and jogging outfits and oils and unguents and grow lights, the works. This year, he is into simple ignorance. "It's all crap," says he, "all lies. Your senses lie to you, the president lies to you. The more you search, the less you find, the more you try, the worse it gets. Ignorance is bliss. Just be, man. Don't think or do, just be. The world is coming to an end." This was written several years ago. The day before he left from visiting us, Fulgham writes, he jumped off a lakeside dock with his clothes on to help a kid who appeared to be in danger of drowning in the deep water. And he confessed to being in town for the National Lawyers Guild Convention, since he's a member of the Social Justice Committee. So, if it's all lies and crap, and ignorance is the ultimate trip, then how come, I say? Well, says he, I might be wrong. Jim concludes, pieces of sanity are found washed ashore in all kinds of beaches these days, and skepticism and realism are not the same as cynicism and pessimism. I mention it because it seems like a good bumper sticker for our times. I may be wrong. Where is hope nurtured and strengthened? Right here. That, I believe, is one of the primary purposes of gathering in religious community. Uh-oh. Another word that sometimes makes us uncomfortable, religious, relating to that which is acknowledged as ultimate reality, says Webster's Third International Dictionary. Manifesting devotion to and reflecting the nature of the divine, or that which one holds to be of ultimate importance. Maybe we need to get over some of our fear of certain words. Maybe we would speak with more authority and more clarity if we could admit that maybe we are religious people. We are people who come together to find a sacred space in our busy lives. And if our religious, sacred beliefs don't include anyone's dogma, does that make them any less real? If the sacred is, as I believe, to be found in our relationships with each other and how we treat each other, does that make us any less religious, any less people of faith? We Unitarian Universalists are heirs to a rich heritage. It needs to be shared. We have a place in this dialogue, in this debate about how to respond to acts of terrorism. Our heritage and our principles, especially the sixth one, not a quiz. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, and the seventh one, we all know the seventh one, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Our heritage and our principles compel us to speak up, to speak often. Speak forcefully. How do you get people to think out of the box? To begin to understand the importance of being world citizens, not just citizens of the United States. And I do believe we can be both. How do you get people to think of the whole human race, not just of themselves or their immediate families? How do you get them to consider the possibility that there are other ways to secure our homes and keep our loved ones safe than by reverting to an ancient, unworkable, unsuccessful practice of an eye for an eye? How do you do this? You might do it with words and actions that are spoken and performed mindfully, love, and always with stand and lead in freedom, grace, and power. There must be those who speak honestly and do not avoid seeing what must be seen of sorrow and outrage, fresh worlds. There must be those whose exuberance rises with lovely energy that articulates earth's joys. There must be those who are restless for respectful and loving companionship among human beings, whose presence invites people to be themselves without fear. There must be those who gather with the congregation of remembrance and compassion, draw water from old wells, and walk the simple path of love for neighbor. And there must be communities of people who seek to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly, who call on the strength of soul force to heal, transform, and bless life. There must be religious witness. May we go from here this morning with these words in mind, and may we figure out how to speak effectively, spiritually, from a deep place, the words that must be spoken. What an opportunity we have right now. This is a moment to be seized, a moment in human history to truly begin to recognize and appreciate our interconnectedness. But without the words spoken clearly, plainly, from that deep well of love and mindfulness and hope, what we right now only imagine can be, will never be.
Can we say thank you to Sandy today? We will have closing words by Sandy.
Go in peace. Live simply, gently, at home in yourselves. Act justly. Speak justly. Remember the depth of your own compassion. Forget not your power in the days of your powerlessness. Do not desire to be wealthier than your peers, and stint not your hand of charity. Practice forbearance. Speak the truth or speak not. Take care of yourselves as bodies, for you are a good gift. Crave peace for all people in the world, beginning with yourselves, and go as you go with the dream of that peace alive in your heart. Amen. Blessed be. Thank you.